This is Caught in the Act with Tim Clark.
Welcome back. Blood, violence, and death seem to follow the name of Ed House. Andrew Ed House, Robert Ed House, father and son, bonded by blood and also bikie brethren from different eras, both linked to a string of gruesome crimes. One of them suburban and solved, one of them masked, dangerous and not proved, and another wild and western, and still some significant way from being concluded. On Caught in the Act this week, we will explore the violent worlds of two members of one family which collided in one shocking courtroom outburst and could come together again before a coroner in a few short months. Joining me again to explore the case of the State of Western Australia against Robert Wayne Ed House and how his father Andrew fits in to his family's deadly history is the West Australian's chief reporter, Ben Harvey. Halves, thanks for sparing some time, mate.
That's all right. You know, one day you're going to invite me on the show. We're going to talk about a nice white-collar crime with no victims other than financial ones, and my family will be very happy for it.
Yeah, well, you're the one wearing the white collar today, yeah. so maybe we should explore that later. So before we dive into the details, tell us a little bit about Andrew Ed House and how he first came to the attention of the police and the general public.
To understand Andrew Ed House, you've got to understand the Club Darrow's Outlaw Motorcycle Club. Mm. This is probably the most secretive bikie gang in Western Australia, one of the most secretive in Australia. Even to this day, WA police don't really know how many patched members there are of the Club Darrow's. You didn't hear anything about them. They were formed in the early 1970s, one of the original four gangs in Western Australia. That was Club Darrow's, Coffin Cheaters, Gypsy Jokers, and the God's Garbage Gang. Mm. And they kept completely out of the headlights. Like, no one knew anything about them. In fact, it was not until 1999 that the name Andrew Wayne Ed House first appeared in the West Australian newspaper, and it was because he'd belted a cop, allegedly, who had stopped him as he came out of a tattoo show somewhere in Belmont, I think it was, on Abernethy Road. But up until then, we knew nothing about Andrew Ed House. We knew nothing about the Club Darrow's.
Long before the days of Instagram, TikTok, and,
called the good old days, Tim, when it was just the newspaper, the radio station, and the TV news bulletin. Mm.
So, as Harves has just said, the bikie family tree in WA is littered with broken limbs and worse. In the late 90s, the Coffin Cheaters were a growing force, with their Bayswater clubhouse and the late night activities within a growing irritant to those who lived around it. More than an irritant was a bloke called Kevin Mad Mick Woodhouse, who had been kicked out of the less formidable and very secretive Club Darrow's because he still owed them money. Instead of taking his whack and taking some leave, Woodhouse took up with the Coffin Cheaters instead. And Harves, that prompted a war.
It was all over a pretty modest legal bill. Mm. So the Darrow's apparently had paid his lawyer for a charge that he got off. And then he went and skipped over to the Coffin Cheaters. Now, apparently the Darrow's were okay with him going to another club. They just wanted him to pony up and pay the bill. They thought it was dirty pool that they had got him out of jail or kept him out of jail, and then he skidded over to Eddie Withnell's mob. Mm. And that's what started one of the bloodiest encounters in not just West Australian bikie law, but Australian bikie history. It was a two-year war between the Club Darrow's and the Coffin Cheaters that started with an audacious attack on one of Australia's best-known bikies at that point, Eddie Withnell, who was the face of Bindoon Rock. Eddie was drinking at the Broken Hill Hotel in Victoria Park when a bunch of Club Darrow members ran in and they almost severed his ear in the attack, in the knife attack. This was in front of normal punters just having a drink at the bar. They went full chopper-eed on him. That triggered a tit-for-tat sort of war between the Darrows and the Coffin Cheaters that got increasingly bloody as time went on. We had a guy called David Whittaker, massive, massive Coffin Cheater, who ended up in Swan District's hospital. He had a bullet hole in his leg. After that, we had a Club Darrow's bikie, Brian Edhouse, brother to Andrew Edhouse. He had his both legs broken in a baseball attack at a mechanic shop that he was working at. Then we had, and this really commanded a lot of headlines, a Coffin Cheater was caught by police just metres from the Balga home of a Club Darrows member. The Coffin Cheater had an automatic shotgun which had the street name the Street Sweeper, because you could clear an entire road in a matter of seconds. And this image was put on the front page of the West Australian newspaper. And it was so confronting. It's such an enormous, terrifying weapon. The people of Western Australia were genuinely worried about what was going to happen.
I think the police at the time called it a weapon of war, because that's basically what it was designed to do, not to take out a rival gang member down Bayswater way.
That's right. It was alarming for just about everyone. The cops realised by this stage this is going to get really bloody. It's going to get wet, as they say in the trade. And they launched Operation Gallipoli, which obviously has its own war connotations. And they had the Outlaw Motorcycle Gang Task Force formed, who were going to crack down on the gangs, which they did with dubious efficiency over the next few months, because we still had the body count rise.
And then, after all this bloodshed, the chaotic crescendo. Club Darrow Mark Doyle is on his way to work in his car when a shooter sprays him with bullets from the on-ramp of the Roe Highway. He suffers gunshot wounds to his spine. The very next day, Coffin Cheater Mark Chabrier was shot dead in his car in Welshpool. Fellow gang member Mick Anderson was shot in the arm in the same attack.
They were two very popular members of the Coffin Cheaters, well regarded. So Mark Chabrier, or Shabs as he was known, was an old school bikie, very well regarded just across the clubs, not just within the Coffin Cheaters. And Mick Anderson, Big Mick, they called him. The folklore around Big Mick was he was so enormous, when the cops arrested him, they had to put two lots of handcuffs linked together so that they could actually get his arms behind his back. Enormous mountain of a man who was nearly killed in this attack.
And baby-faced Club Darrow member Andrew Wayne Edhouse was eventually charged with Shabs's murder. Harbs, we've spoken on this podcast before about bikey violence and, you know, how it's somewhat out of step with the rest of sort of Perth's beachside laid-back culture. This series of unfortunate events, look, it might just have been club on club, but it was still brutal. This was something out of the box.
Well, we'd never seen this in Western Australia. It had never been a pitched street battle. Bikies had gone to war before, but it was always done in the shadows. It was always done on farms in the middle of nowhere. It was done in abandoned industrial sites in Malaga, in Beachborough. And it was done in the dead of night. This was shootings, stabbings in the middle of day, broad daylight, in very, very normal businesses. Very, very normal businesses. Mm. Pubs, clubs, restaurants, mechanics. It was the kind of thing that was just writ large over headlines for days and weeks and months. Mm. And it was quite terrifying for that brief period in late 1998, early 1999. There was a definite sense that the police were not in control. Mm.
And it took them more than a year to charge Edhouse, mostly because of that bikey code of silence, which we've covered before.
Well, this was genuine bikey code of silence, because the Club Darrows and Coffin Cheaters were genuine bikey gangs. This is well before Nike bikers. Mm. This isn't sort of wannabe Rock Machine members and all that kind of stuff. To become a member of the Coffin Cheaters or Club Darrows, outlaw motorcycle gangs, you had to have proved your worth. You had to have proved that you were staunch. You didn't just walk in. like some clubs, if you pony up your fee and you pay your due and you've got your Harley that you can give the club, well, then you're automatically a member. Mm. You had to get into some pretty deep criminal shit to be a club dero or a coffin cheater back then.
At Ed House's first appearance in court, everyone was locked out. At the next, the media at least were let in and heard details of the alleged hit. A bronze Ford Falcon overtaking a Ford Fairlane driven by Chabrier. Ed House allegedly wearing a balaclava, leaning out of the window and unloading a hail of bullets, which pierced Chabrier's lungs, heart, neck and brain. The motive, the escalating violence, which had seen Ed House's brother bashed amid the tit-for-tat violence. And at the opening of the trial that followed, which was held amid unprecedented security, prosecutor Bruno Fianacca went further, revealing Ed House had told an associate he had wet dreams over the shootings. Mr. Fianacca pointed to confessions Ed House had allegedly made. He revealed forensic links between Ed House and shotguns, and he pointed to the motive, the bashing of his brother and the lust for revenge. Ed House's lawyer, Remy van der Veel QC, said those pieces to the jigsaw just didn't quite fit together. They were being forced to fit by a police force desperate for a result. And after a trial lasting weeks, it took a jury just one day to come back and say that Andrew Ed House was not guilty of the murder of Mark Chabrier. As was the febrile atmosphere in Perth, Ed House felt the safest place for him was still in prison, awaiting more charges of threatening and assaulting police. Harves, this was a big trial and at the end of it, a big blow for WA police because they were pretty sure that they had their man.
It was a huge embarrassment. Mm. And it was especially embarrassing because this trial collapsed 2 or 3 weeks after there was a change of government. So Richard Court's Liberal government was booted out and Jeff Gallop's Labor government came in. So there was a new premier, a new police minister, all these people looking at the cops saying, what on earth have you been up to? How did this happen? Extremely embarrassing for the police commissioner at that time.
Mm. And then the fallout from the prosecution, as it unwound in the public eye, left the police with more bruises because there was allegations of misconduct by senior police involved in Gallipoli, the operation, not
yes,
the war.
Yes. So it was the cop that was in the frame for this was a very, very old school police officer called George Loverock.
I love the name.
Yes.
You could see it above a bar somewhere.
Yep. So George Loverock was one of those old school coppers who joined when he was quite young. This is back when cops had a minimum height requirement to be a police. I would never have got it, never been able to get in. George Loverock was this towering figure. He was of this sort of Don Hancock style era of policing, along with another chap called John Standing, who you might remember, who was an assistant commissioner. These were the type of guys who just took no shit. Absolutely no shit. John Standing, there's this wonderful, probably incorrect story, but I'm going to tell it anyway, about how when he was cracking down on bikies during this 98-99 period and he was getting on top of the coffin cheaters and the club deros, apparently 4 bikies rolled up outside his house, his private residence, and they were revving their engines. And John Standing just sauntered out in his dressing gown, didn't have a care in the world, and just quietly slapped defect notices on the 4 Harleys and then wandered back onto his front porch. Now, I don't know if that's true, but it gives you a sense of how these men conducted themselves. George Loverock was one of them. George basically roughed up Andrew Ed House. One of the cops that saw it happen freaked out, thought they were going to get hauled before what was then the Anti-Crime Commission, the predecessor to the Corruption and Crime Commissioner, and Commission, and made a report and complaint. And then the CCTV footage of the interview mysteriously went missing. George Loverock ultimately said, I communicate with people on their level. And when you're communicating with a career bikie like Andrew Ed House, you've got to communicate in a way that they understand.
Well, that was his reasoning. But Bruno Fianacca, the prosecutor, is now a Supreme Court judge. I spend quite a bit of time in red velvet rooms with Mr. Fianacca now, or Justice Fianacca as he is. They decided that not only was the confession that Andrew Edhouse gave not going to be used in court, but neither was Lovrock. I mean, he wasn't even called as a witness, and he was in charge of Gallipoli. So, I mean, that must have sent red flags flying to anyone who made the connections.
Yes, yeah, it was very embarrassing. So, it wasn't a great period for WA Police, and if they could all do it again, they would have done it very, very differently. This was at a time, though, where we didn't have the technology that we have now. Mm. This is a time when if someone gets shot, you really do need some kind of a confession unless you've got eyewitnesses. Mm. And the thing with bikie shootings is very few people admit they actually saw it happen.
Yeah. Eventually, Andrew Edhouse did leave prison somewhat nervously. His prospective address was suppressed. His lawyer said Mr. Edhouse wasn't worried, but he wasn't taking any chances either. And he managed to stay out of prison, even after being charged over a pub brawl, which triggered a suspended sentence that had been handed down when he had confronted two police officers in Kalgoorlie with a machete and then impact another officer with his head. From there, it appeared from the outside that Andrew Edhouse largely stayed out of trouble, apart from some skirmishes on the fringes. But something from his past was going to rear a very ugly head. In 1999, almost a year to the day from the shocking shooting of Marc Chabrier, a young woman called Lisa Govan was in and out in Kalgoorlie, in the mood for a night out. Harps, you've followed the case of Lisa Govan extensively. What happened on that night?
So October 1999, it was a crisp afternoon in Kalgoorlie. She had just dropped her boyfriend off to a night shift at the Super Pit. It was about 5 p.m. and Lisa, who was in her 20s, blue eyes, brown hair, very small, was in the mood for a night out. She first of all went to the Exchange Hotel. She didn't actually get into the Exchange Hotel because she was barred from getting into that particular pub. Now, let's get something very, very clear. Lisa Govan was no cheerleader angel. Lisa Govan took drugs. Lisa Govan hung out with some very rough men. That's what we're dealing with. And that the reason I'm making that point now, it clouded the police investigation, which we'll get into a bit later on. She ended up at the Safari nightclub on Hannon Street in Kalgoorlie at 4:45 a.m. That was the last time we saw her. Now, they say that nothing good happens after midnight. Believe me, nothing good happens at 4:45 a.m. at the Safari nightclub in Kalgoorlie.
This so-called missing person case, it remains unsolved all these years on. But a couple of years ago, you returned to it and put together a detailed documentary called Finding Lisa's Killer. Listeners can find it on the West website, but we've got you now. So give us the background and what you uncovered for the first time about the disappearance of Lisa Govan.
The most striking new bit of information was the emergence of fresh CCTV that showed Lisa at the Safari nightclub. Now, for 20 years, we had been told the last sighting of Lisa Govan was at 4:45 a.m. at the Safari nightclub, and the club was about to close and she was there and she was about to walk downstairs to walk out. For the first time, we found out the cops had actually been keeping a secret from us for 2 decades. It wasn't the last time she was seen. The last time she was seen was actually when she was downstairs outside the club in an alleyway. And there's CCTV that we covered in Catching Lisa's Killer that actually showed what happened next. It showed that she was with two well-known bikies.
And one of those two bikies was Andrew Edhouse.
This is the thing that came out of nowhere. Police, for some reason, had decided that they were going to keep this piece of information secret for 20 years. They decided that tactic obviously wasn't working because 20 years later they still didn't have any handcuffs on anyone. And so they actually said Lisa Govan was seen with Andrew Edhouse. They were kissing each other in the alleyway outside the Safari nightclub. From that point on, Lisa went back to the Club Darrow clubhouse, which was on Boulder Road. It's about a 5-10 minute drive at the most. And that's where she met her end. Police say she died inside that clubhouse.
And there was also evidence that you uncovered, and I think that was touched on at the time, but much more in detail when you got there, of a ute that was seen at the club and then not at that club.
This was the second bit of information that the police for some reason had kept secret for a very, very long time. So witnesses say they saw her standing outside the Club Darrow clubhouse around 7:45 a.m. Two reasonably good witnesses told police that. Police think that she went back inside the club after that. And then sometime that morning, a Toyota Land Cruiser trayback pulled in to the clubhouse. An item was taken out of the clubhouse and put on the back of that ute and driven away. Hours later, the ute comes back to the clubhouse and is meticulously cleaned down.
6,041 days from the disappearance of Lisa Govan, more blood was spilled. About 6 hours and 41 minutes away from where that young woman was last seen. In Girraween, a cosy little suburb about 25 minutes north of Perth. About 5 minutes from where I live and still do. In 2016, that house on Arnos Way was owned by Alan Taylor. He worked on the mines, fly in, fly out, so was only at home for short bursts of any month. But when he was in Perth, he was close to his family and spent time with his three-year-old son and his partner, Melanie Atwood. When he was away, Atwood stayed at the house, but she was not the only one. Also stopping there were some of her friends. A young man called Corey Dimmock, an even younger 17-year-old who they all knew, and a tall, striking 22-year-old man with a shaved head and a sure smile. Robert Wayne Edhouse, son of Andrew. Halves, Robert Edhouse was an accepted brother and sort of local leader of a small but still very nasty little group called Aryan Nations.
Aryan Nations is a very small outfit in Australia, not so in the US. Mm-hmm. In the US, it is basically an modern-day Ku Klux Klan. That's the only way to really talk about it. And it's very powerful within the prison system. It's basically the gang you join if you're white in jail. Mm. Because the last thing you want to be is an unaligned white guy surrounded by the Bloods and the Crips, et cetera, and the Mexican cartels, because if you don't have any muscle behind you, you are just a sitting duck. That's basically where it draws its membership from. I don't think that people who become members of Aryan Nation inside jail necessarily do so because they're intrinsically racist. They do it because they're intrinsically scared.
Yeah, they're not all reading Mein Kampf, I don't think. But
No. This is not a romper stomper style outfit in America. This is a serious, serious criminal organisation that's penetrated the criminal justice system. Not so much in Australia. Very, very small in Australia. For some reason, this bloke was attracted to that lifestyle.
And so this misfit sort of band had found each other. Atwood had become the leader of the women's section of the Aryan Nations, and she'd also invited them all to stay at Alan Taylor's house. And bizarrely, Mr. Taylor didn't seem to mind, but what he didn't know was that Atwood and Edhouse had become romantically involved, shall we say.
Yes, it just seems that he was hopelessly naive to what was happening before his very eyes. Oh, tragically naive, as it turns out. You know, he had this Nazi paraphernalia around the house, swastikas everywhere.
Swords on the wall.
He wasn't asking questions. Yeah. He wasn't asking, who are these guys? Why are they here all the time? And it was to his ultimate detriment because he died as a result of this.
Alan Taylor didn't know that Melanie Atwood and Robert Edhouse were lovers. And he also didn't know that Edhouse was coming as he dozed in his own bed on the morning of April 22nd, 2016. It was to that home on that day that an ambulance was called by Atwood, who claimed she had returned to find the father of her child beaten to death. But that story was concocted, as was the apparent wailing grief cited by police who were called at the report of a violent break-in. Atwood's story was that she had come home and found her man dead. The real story, quickly uncovered by already suspicious police, was much more shocking. Harves, what really happened to Alan Taylor?
Well, to put it brutally succinctly, he was beaten to death by Ed House, who used a hammer to kill him. There's no way around shortening that or making it more complicated than it actually was. It was a quick, brutal assault that saw him killed. Now, they thought that they had covered their tracks, and they thought that they had laid enough sort of crumbs going elsewhere that they were going to get away with this crime. Look, the cops had it over these people within 2 minutes arriving at the front door. When you are a member of a neo-Nazi group and you're the son of a Club Darrow senior elder statesman who has been on murder charges before, chances are you're going to come under some pretty intense police questioning and investigative methodology. Mm. And that's what happened. And soon it was exposed as the House of Cards.
Yeah. Melanie Atwood was also involved in the planning of this crime. She basically wanted to get Alan Taylor out of the way so she could take up with her new Nazi man. They discussed various ways of killing Alan Taylor, including by giving him a hot shot of drugs. But eventually they came upon a much more brutal and simple way. You go in, I'll stay outside, you take the hammer, and then we'll go to the cinema, which is what they did immediately after they had killed Alan Taylor.
The Jungle Book.
The Jungle Book. They went to see at my local cinema up at Warwick. They, when they were there, Corey Dimmock and the younger man scooted off to the nearby Coles or Woolies to get some, not get Maltesers, but get some deodorant to cover the smell of blood and body odour that was still on them. And then they all went their separate ways, apart from Atwood, who went home and then claimed to have found her partner and father of her child dead.
This is basically Full Metal Psycho behaviour. This is just unbelievable that you could do this. You could oversee or take part in a brutal hammer murder and then go to the movies and then have the wherewithal to think, am I can smell blood here, we better do something about that. I mean, that takes a certain type of person to continue on amidst all that.
And probably the most shocking fact of all was that when that group left to go to the cinema, Alan Taylor was still alive, and he probably died between 3 and 5 hours after that attack happened. A jury ultimately found that Atwood and young Robert had come up with a plan together. They wanted to be together and thought they could also scoop Mr. Taylor's $1 million life insurance policy. I was in court the day a jury found Robert Edhouse and Melanie Atwood guilty of the murder of Alan Taylor. So were Alan's parents, Rosemary and Robert, and so was someone else, his Uncle Brian, brother of Andrew. As the newly convicted killer was led down to the cells ahead of an inevitable life sentence, his veneer of a misunderstood, non-violent ne'er-do-well fell away in a shocking moment. He launched a flurry of punches to the back of the head of his co-accused and former Nazi acolyte Dimmock. And as that uproar exploded, Brian Edhouse surged from the back of the court in an attempt to enter the body. He was stopped by security and quickly led away. But it was a flash of the violence which had seeped from the Edhouse family for so long. A display of contempt for the law and justice, which WA police had spoken about in relation to that family for more than two decades. Robert Edhouse got life with a minimum of 21 years for Alan Taylor's murder. His lover, Atwood, got the same. He was also punished for a contempt of court. And Harves, back to Lisa Govan. During your investigation, you found out that young Robert was very close by during the last hours she was seen alive.
He was metres away from where Lisa Govan died. He was a toddler, and he was in a house that was just in front of the Club Darrow's clubhouse. He was there on the morning that Lisa Govan died, and he was there when that Toyota Land Cruiser Trayback pulled in and retrieved a bundle. He was there when the Toyota Land Cruiser drove away. He was there when the Toyota Land Cruiser returned and was meticulously cleaned down.
That's incredible, isn't it? That a young, very young, seemingly innocent toddler at the time could be even in the vicinity of something so murky.
It does make you wonder whether or not this kid had a chance in life from the get-go.
So the younger Edhouse, as I've just said, he'll be in prison until he's a middle-aged man. His father is still a free man, but there is a chance that he might be called back to a judicial setting in the not-too-distant future.
The police have concluded their investigation into the death of Lisa Govan. Her body's never been found, by the way. They've got some theories about where it is. The most credible theory at the moment is that Toyota Land Cruiser that we discussed had travelled within an hour south of Kalgoorlie. They had deposited the bundle that was on the back of the tray, which was Lisa's body, in a mine site. They had put dynamite down and they had detonated to destroy all evidence. Now, we don't know for sure if that's the case. We don't know what Andrew Edhouse saw in that clubhouse. We don't know what he knows. But the state coroner is going to try and get some answers, because now that the police file has been closed, it is up to the state coroner to hold a judicial inquest into whether or not Lisa is in fact dead, as we suspect, and do their best to work out how she died. As part of that process, they will call Andrew Edhouse to testify. Andrew Edhouse will not say anything, and he will cop a $3,000 fine or whatever it is, and he will walk away. But it is going to be played out in the next few months. We understand that it should be held this year, and I think it will be very, very embarrassing for police as much as damning for the Club Darrow's.
And under the Coroner's Act, the coroner that sits, presumably will sit at that public inquiry, has some very specific powers. They can compel people to appear. They can subpoena people. They can order them to be at a certain place at a certain time. And in certain circumstances, they can also tell a witness that anything you say here today cannot be used against you in a court of law, if you want to use that cliche. They can sign a special notice which will say, I want you to tell me the truth because my job is to get to the truth of how this person died. To get to that truth, we are not going to put you at risk of being arrested and charged. So it could be, you never know. You could be in the ludicrous position of Andrew Edhouse turning up one, you know, Thursday afternoon at the coroner's court and say, yeah, I saw her die. I rang a mate. He came and put her in a ute and took her, bowled away and blew her up.
Yep.
And he might never be charged with that.
It's possible. It's unlikely, of course, that Andrew's going to say anything. What's more likely to my mind is someone else who was there that morning in the clubhouse says something. So there were 7 or 8 people in the clubhouse when Lisa Govan died, and not all of them were bikies. And they have grown up. They're in their 20s then. Mm. They're now in their 50s. Mm. They probably harbour a lot of guilt. They probably harbour still a lot of fear. But I think that as time has gone on, they may be more inclined to speak now than they were in the late 1990s.
There's $1 million on offer as well, isn't there?
Well, there's also that. Don't worry about assuaging your own guilt. It might be about filling your own bank balance. If they can provide information that leads to the conviction of someone, there is a $1 million reward on the table. Now, at the moment, that $1 million reward, which has been on the table now for a couple of years, hasn't been claimed, because obviously the people that know what happened to Lisa. And there are at least a half a dozen people alive in Australia right now who know exactly what happened to Lisa Govan that morning in October 1999 inside the Club Darrow's clubhouse. They know exactly what happened. They haven't tried to claim the $1 million, even though they had nothing to do with the death, because they are worried that they will get killed. That's why the reward has not been claimed. They say it is not worth $1 million to put myself offside with the Club Darrow's outlaw motorcycle gang.
Blood money on many levels. Now, the postscript to this tale of feral family ties is also very strange and very concerning. In 2021, it emerged that Robert Edhouse had hatched a plan to try and escape his jail cell and had re-recruited an old mate, Corey Dimmock, the man he had flailed punches at as the pair were being led away after the murder trial, had been contacted on the outside. From October 2020 onwards, in a series of recorded prison phone calls between the pair, they plotted the jailbreak. The plot involved the attempted extortion of $5,000 from a man who had given interviews to the police in relation to the murder of Alan Taylor. The intention was to use the money to buy broomsticks, their code word for guns. Edhouse wrote coded letters from prison using cheat codes from the video game Red Dead Redemption. There were also veiled discussions of guerrilla warfare tactics being employed to make good the escape. But the plot was sprung and Edhouse placed in Supermax for a time. He was eventually sentenced to 3 years and 9 months for that plot to run alongside his life term. Harves, thanks so much for helping us unpack the life and crimes of the family Edhouse.
If you want to know any more about it, anyone listening can Google Catching Lisa's Killer and they will find a 6-part documentary that fills in a lot more information about what happened in Kalgoorlie back in 1999.
It's well worth a watch. And thanks to you all for joining us again. Please don't hesitate to get in touch with us by writing to courtintheact@wanews.com.au. Don't forget to like and subscribe and tell your family, friends, colleagues and co-accused all about us. And remember, if you want to know what's going on in court, don't get caught short. Get caught in the act instead. See you next week.